Welcome to this podcast sponsored by Siemens Healthineers Digital Health and brought to you by HIMSS. I'm Dr. Liana Romero, Head of Global Marketing, Clinical Decision Solutions, and I'm here today with two great guests from the University of Missouri Healthcare. First, Dr. Mark Wakefield, Associate Chief Medical Officer and Chief of the Division of Urology, and Brian Bliven, Chief Information Officer and Vice President, Executive Director of the Tiger Institute for Health Innovation. Today, we're going to talk about the digital health transformation and leadership required to successfully and sustainably implement clinical decision support in a healthcare system. Welcome, Dr. Wakefield and Brian. Great to connect again. It was only a short couple of weeks ago that we had an opportunity to have a great conversation as we presented a webinar, Enabling Clinical Decision Support View from the C-Suite. And during that webinar, we talked about implementing clinical decision support and how it can bring clinical, operational, and financial benefits for the healthcare institution. But really, more important, it's the benefits to the patient, right? In achieving right tests first time, accuracy in diagnosis, with the aid of artificial intelligence, getting the patient involved in their personalized course of treatment and keeping them involved during the treatment and follow-up. And these are really all factors that can really contribute to patient outcomes. So from your views, now that we've had a few days to kind of digest this great topic, who's in the driver's seat institutionally to lead the transformation for widespread use of clinical decision support? Is it IT? Is it the clinical side? Or is it a village of all the stakeholders that are involved?
I think that the clinic, for this to be most successful, a clinical champion has to be identified who can envision the benefit for the patient and the provider of decision support, and then a partner in IT to make it happen.
See, I'm glad Dr. Wakefield went first because I wasn't going to say anything until he did, because I think that the clinician should definitely be in front of the technology. And I can appreciate what Dr. Wakefield is saying around the finances side of it. A lot of the times, how you get started does come with that initial investment. But once you've determined kind of the why of implementing clinical decision support, it really needs to be clinician-led and IT-enabled. And you need to start with where, justifying like where in the workflows things could even be. And the clinicians are the ones that need to really help with that.
I mean, when we think about clinical decision support, this is a movement that really started actually back in the 1980s and then picked up a lot of momentum again when Choosing Wisely did their full exercise on appropriate use criteria of diagnostic testing and so forth. But yet the ramp up or the adoption of it has been probably slower than what we had originally anticipated, kind of knowing where things were going. And I know, Brian, we spoke about meaningful use, right? That meaningful use had been to some degree an impetus for driving that. But do you think now with the advent of the clinical decision support solutions that are supported and enabled by artificial intelligence that there's maybe a different level of interest? I'd like to hear both of your opinions on this. I mean, how do you think things are different now?
You know, I think that's a good question. There's a lot of promise when you digitize an industry, and that's one of the things that's been in healthcare IT for the past 20 years. And I've definitely felt that a digital transformation can yield a lot of benefits as it has in other industries. But the complexities of patient care and the many variables are difficult. And I think that we put a lot, our physicians, our clinicians have put a lot of trust in the future that the entry, the data entry, the using the chart and having a single source of truth is ultimately going to drive these types of benefits, but it's been really slow in coming. And meaningful use was one driver of you need to use your system, not just for data data entry, but you need to have it support some clinical decisions. And the problem was, especially at the outset, is there was the ability to really kind of check the box, and it was all well intentioned around, let's make sure that we don't have any direct interactions, and you don't have to just maybe remember certain things, like an example of like Accutane with pregnancy, and if there's something there that would pop up and show you that those are not indicated together. But it's not this higher level decision support where you're planning out an entire pathway and taking into account changing variables and the longevity of a condition that really could aid the clinician. A lot of it was it'll aid in memory recollection or do some basic checks, but now we're getting to the point with technology and need to build the trust with the clinicians that we can ingest and formulate all of the different sources of information and data and come back with really aiding in complex areas and helping the provider to find the best course of along the whole path of the continuum of care. And I think that we're approaching that with some of the more advanced tools now. And I think that just gives me more promise for the future to keep going and keep trying to work on ways that we can have better workflows for our clinicians and our patients.
Dr. Wakefield, thoughts on this?
So we've been interested in prostate cancer as the clinical domain to test this. And it's gotten a lot more complicated in the last 10 years as we've, of course, learned more about the disease, but also as we've had more diagnostic and therapeutic options. So this is where I think clinical decision support will be especially valuable as new information is laid upon classic knowledge. How do we use that real time and make it easy for us to have that information fresh at hand and deploy that in the near future clinically as an example?
Yeah, we've talked about having that single truth, right? And I think certainly from one of the challenges has been that obviously, particularly from a clinician perspective, it's the overwhelming of all the different systems that have to at times be accessed in order to make the decisions and kind of drive the care practices and so forth. So I think that aspect of it, of kind of creating maybe the not only the awareness, but the acceptance that clinical decision support is not an EMR, but rather that integrates with the EMR and can serve as an aid to clinical practice is key, right, to successful implementation. So how do we address that aspect? How do we really drive that change management aspect of saying, this is really here to aid you, not burden you?
So I think that's a great point. And I was thinking about my clinical experience this morning. One key is to make it easy for the clinician, either in the user interface or the connection to near real-time data. And the example today was, I wanted to look up some risk predictors, and there's a lot of tools available and they're dispersed. But then I had to log out of the EMR or at least minimize the page and then go get on a web browser. And then one particular interface that I was working with was relying on pretty archaic interface, and it wasn't easy. And it was, it was important for the care of the patient to have this kind of information available, but as I was doing it, all I could think is there's got to be a better way to get the information at the data real time to the clinician while they're doing the work with the patient.
So Brian, then that speaks to the IT transformation aspect, right? So how do you drive this from within the institution to facilitate that whole process and make it say, user-friendly for your clinicians?
You know, there's a lot that goes into the electronic medical records, and it's really more than just a medical record. It really drives a lot of workflows. And anytime that we have to drive away from that, meaning that there can't be something right in Dr. Wakefield's workflow that if he's looking for information, he doesn't have any easy access to it, it causes him to context shift and go and search, you know, that's going to be a delay. And I think what, especially with a lot of these conditions where there's massive complexities and different types of data that's out there that has to be collated together to help paint a picture, including like the patient's wishes, et cetera, you need to figure out how to integrate that within the workflow. And that doesn't, I think the data that we shared in our presentation was around 75% of organizations are looking for technology outside of their EMR to do this. When I say outside of their EMR, like outside of their EMR vendor, but you want to have it integrated and you'd like to have it seamless to the provider. But we're talking different types of data sets, like imaging data, and then also adding in the machine learning aspect and be able to compare with the cases that we and other institutions have had in the past and look at progression, if we're talking about the prostate example, over time, and then calculate in lab work and other information and data into a place where it makes sense when you're having the conversation with the patient or you're wanting to study that case. Having it all within one area, so all the relevant data and information is right there, instead of, well, I see this piece of information, now I need to go and launch another tool or fill out some data into another system for it to compute a risk percentage, when, you know, really we want to take that data and have the calculators and have that type of information right at the point of care or the workflow that's being executed.
So, I think a big piece of this too is the maintenance aspect of it, right? Because as the IT solutions evolve, as new ones are added and old ones get maybe retired or upgraded and so forth, it's, you know, how do you maintain that architecture working constantly, right? Without potentially falling into some pitfalls, if you will, which may or may not be obvious at first. But how will you keep all of those moving parts, let's say, working?
You know, in the past, the more complex that IT here at our organization would make a particular decision support tool or rule, it was basically creating our own program. And if the variables or the evidence shifted over time, or even the types of data that were available, your decision support tool becomes irrelevant. What we're doing now is partnering with organizations such as Siemens Health and Ears and implementing the decision support that is going to be shared and co-curated, so to speak, so that it is up to date. We'll take updates to the logic and to the data mapping and constantly kind of revisit it. It's just more complex. And a lot of that had to be owned within our organization, which is hard to scale and support. And what we're counting on our partners to do is to help carry that load. And then hopefully it's also lifting that burden for other organizations.
And we talked as clinical example in the past about how do you manage to keep up to date with clinical guidelines and staging documents. And those are part of our routine, but it's easy to be an addition behind. And so an automated system keeps you fresh and on the most current versions rather than relying on memory or even, you know, the textbook is printed and it's almost out of date. As it comes off the press, some things are changing so quickly.
Yeah.
I always think a conversation that I've had with some providers in the past where they would ask the very relevant question is, shouldn't a computer be able to do this for us, right? And a lot of the times it's, well, yes, but you got to think about the complexities and the different areas. And I just, we're getting to that point where the answer is yes, and it can. And then we need to build kind of that learning system and build trust in it. And that's been really the shift as we went to an AI-powered clinical decision support. where it is more flexible and a learning system over time that we can tweak and turn rather than have to reprogram. It's a different context.
So it's interesting because you touched on a really, I would say, critical aspect of maybe both the challenge and the benefit of clinical decision support, in that historically, there's always been this concern that you don't want the software to make solutions for the clinician, right? Because there needs to be that ability to have objectivity, to be able to make changes as you know, as needed, and so forth. And that has been a barrier, perhaps, you know, to adoption. So how is that trend maybe changing? Do you feel like maybe now there's more comfort in what the capabilities of the software can bring and the solutions can bring? Or is it, you know, there's still maybe groups of specializations, maybe more complex specializations that feel like, you know, I really don't want that type of solution helping me? Or and then if that's the case, how do we overcome that, right?
I think this is a great part of change management for an institution. So at MU Healthcare, we've been working very strongly, like all healthcare institutions are, on improving our quality, but also being good stewards of our financial resources. So the value proposition for us is how do we decrease unwarranted variation? How do we maintain high quality care that's economically sustainable? And when we're talking about new discoveries and diagnostic and therapeutic options in prostate cancer, we're talking about very expensive interventions, diagnostic tests, pathology, genomic, and other markers that are going to be utilized during a long course of a patient's care. So if we're not willing to accept support that can help us make good, valued, effective decisions for our patients, we're not going to be allowed to do that. So I think the message that utilizing decision support tools will allow us to be practiced at the top of our ability is a message that requires leadership from clinicians and embracing technology for its benefit. No clinician likes to be told what to do. So how you display that is really important. Mm-hmm. How you coach people that this is a suggestion and variation is acceptable if it's justifiable. But I'm confident that this will help us deliver more advanced care more effectively and as cost-effectively as possible.
So obviously, you know, as you implement clinical decision support and you start to gather information, key performance indicators, metrics, and so forth, I mean, obviously that becomes a conduit towards change in and of itself, right? Because you know, hopefully you see the benefits and you start to actually get to the point where you're documenting all of this. Now, do you feel like this could also be a way to drive awareness from a payer perspective and kind of drive that awareness that clinical decision support in its optimal use can be something that is reimbursable because it provides XYZ value and outcome, you know, et cetera, whatever those metrics are going to be?
So I think it has the potential to help us justify the utilization of expensive resources. So like many institutions, we're using decision support for our advanced radiologic imaging currently. And we're hoping that if we can get justification our decision support endorses our selection of a test that will influence the insurance's willingness to pay and go along and agree. So I see this as a tool that will help us ensure that our pre-authorizations have the meat to get justification and approval from our payers.
Mm-hmm. And in some cases, radiology being a great example, it's going to be required, right? And so we're seeing now where having a certain level of decision support is required for the claim to be able to be successfully processed.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So, I mean, obviously, aside from oncology, what other disease areas do you feel can really benefit from clinical decision support? So, for example, cardiology, also a highly complex disease pathway, neurology, or is it in the realm of the chronic diseases, or maybe even sepsis? I mean, where do you see the world of clinical decision support being able to expand?
You want to take that one, Dr. Wakefield?
Well, yes, and I'm going to get to speculate. I mean, neurology and immunology, rheumatology specialties would seem to me to be excellent candidates as the biological modifying drugs that become available have increasing expense and potential for side effects, that they would be well positioned to be supported for kind of decision support. And then if we, that's following along the same discussion line, is this justification to insurance that these are appropriate selections of these potentially expensive therapeutic options? And and then I also think along the lines of cardiology, you know, there's always that, and now we're getting out of my area of clinical expertise for certain, but is it appropriate, is the timing right for a stress test? Which type of stress test is a cardiac catheterization? You know, as a surgeon, we're asking the cardiologist all the time for their opinion on the risk of a patient to undergo an anesthetic for a procedure. And this may allow them refinement in those assessments and what type of testing would be most appropriate to allow them to quote unquote clear a patient. So I think it's, there's a lot of avenues. I'm especially interested down the road, is this something that could be applied to the management of chronic kidney disease? We're always, trying to determine which patients are good candidates for transplant as a means of renal replacement therapy. And we do a lot of objective testing, but we're also open to more objective or comparative assessments, and algorithms may be able to guide us into safer management of our patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially I would say, you know, with the chronic conditions, there's definitely such an opportunity, because especially when you see disease progression, right? So going from, say, diabetes to chronic kidney disease to heart failure, and all of those pathways somehow potentially interconnecting with the possibility of having predictors of risk or progression of, you know, certain aspects of the disease. I mean, that's kind of my utopia where I would love to see this going. I mean, do you see a future where something like that would also be the ideal, let's say, clinical decision support tool, where you've got the predictor models already incorporated?
Well, now we're going back, you're setting me up to go back to prostate cancer very well, because for the, you know, prostate cancer, who we even start the process of offering screening to should be influenced by the patient's expected longevity. And that's always been a hard thing for clinicians to reliably and comfortably predict. It's not hard or difficult for the insurance actuaries, but we find it difficult clinically. But if we're being wise with our resources, we're not screening for asymptomatic prostate cancer in patients who have a life expectancy that can be predicted based on their known medical conditions, their age, their family longevity, all information that can be obtained from the EMR, and not inappropriately subjecting patients to potentially risky and expensive diagnostic and therapeutic interventions.
Mm-hmm. Definitely the big challenge for prostate, for sure. And obviously always has been a lot of discussion around those parameters of what's the right approach to take. One of the things that we discussed during the webinar as well was obviously that University of Missouri Healthcare has served as a kind of a healthcare lifeline, right, to the rural communities, especially now during this transition with the pandemic. Telehealth became a big source of how the institution was communicating with the patients and so forth. And even though we're well into months of the pandemic, there's still this concern that there are patients, particularly cancer patients, who might still be feeling apprehensive about pursuing their care on site and so forth. And we had talked about how a solution like the AI Pathway Companion could help clinicians remotely engage with their patients. So first, Brian, from an IT perspective, in enabling that type of let's say, expanded access for telemedicine, what's required to make something like that work?
Well, one of the focus areas that we had early on in our response to the pandemic was to enable telehealth platforms and make sure that our patients knew that we're open for business and there's different ways that we can interact. And there are definitely some conditions and scenarios where you need to be seen in person. And we try to articulate that as good as we can, but that also can come through in the conversations if there is one virtually where you need to be seen in person, and let's move that forward. What we had to do to really enable that is provide education. So we had to enable the IT platform, sure, and that's both sides on the provider side. And then we'd educate our patients and their families of what services are available and how to interact virtually. And also, it was really a lot of a PR campaign to promote that we are open for business. And yes, while the pandemic's going on, there's protocols and things in place for safety, but we need to be seeing our patients that need to be seen. And we want to ensure people are thinking about their broader health and not just focusing on one aspect. So a lot of that ended up not being on the technical side. You know, we definitely had to enable the ways for people to communicate and to have the conversations, but we had to make sure that people knew and that they felt safe going through that avenue. A lot of times it was maybe the first time that they had tried to interact with the provider virtually and they didn't know what to expect. So trying to outline that. And a decision support piece, when you have the data and you have the ability to have a conversation, it can aid in the conversation. So I think that's one opportunity that could come out of it. Sometimes, you need to have the tests taken and people might need to come in and interact for that, but a conversation can be held virtually after we gather the appropriate data and that the provider has a chance to examine it so that you can provide that opportunity for the discussion to be virtually, save driving time in the rural part of the state. I know one of the items that we measure is hours saved of windshield time for our patients and coming to see us. And we've definitely seen, we've done our most by far telehealth interactions since the pandemic occurred, which may seem like a no-brainer, but still, you know, doing more in 1 month than we had in the previous year. It shows us what's really possible. And then it's up to us to make sure that we retain the value from that as things shift a little bit and it becomes more of our normal way of doing things. Are we able to retain the value in those virtual encounters and still have that savings of potentially time and interactions and allow people to be safe in their homes and communicate with their providers?
So Dr. Wakefield, kind of piggybacking off of that conversation, and definitely as part of, let's say, the change management that's required from a clinical perspective, we had talked about the fact that of the, you know, value that can be had by being able to have that discussion with the patient around, these are your treatment options, these are, you know, these are the opportunities that you have. So, you know, again, can you share some of your thoughts around how there's still tremendous value in being able to do that virtually or obviously in person, but that the mechanism that can be enabled when you have that information available for those virtual clinical discussions?
You know, this type of support system for clinicians in the setting of increased virtual care is potentially very helpful. You know, sometimes the patients will get their imaging or their laboratory or their other medical records, say, for example, if this is for a second opinion, from disparate sources, and then consolidating that into a useful information about the patient is something that is very promising and will create an easy interface for the clinician that will fuel buy-in. So that has, and that is especially helpful in the setting where patients are being seen in a virtual manner, where they're by definition, likely to get their testing done somewhere else. So it's very helpful for us to have that kind of information. As far as determining what best treatment is available for some patients or giving them information, you know, there's one of my partners has done research on whether patients like a lot of information or like a little bit of information when they're making decisions. And we all know this anecdotally, they'll say, well, you're the doctor, tell me what to do. Which is not something that I'm very comfortable doing. Rather, I'm the provider, I want to give you information and together we'll make a decision is much more comfortable for me clinically. And when we look at the patients with this information about their disease state and give them objective information about the risk of recurrence or progression, for example, then it becomes easier for us to make that discussion meaningful and have a mutually satisfying decision at the end of it. So that holds great hope to help us make better informed shared clinical decision-making with our patients. And prostate cancer is a great area where that's critically important for patient well-being, quality of life, and satisfaction with their therapy.
Yeah, thank you for that. So we've also talked about the opportunity, obviously, for University of Missouri Healthcare to serve as, you know, kind of a, let's say, a best practice trendsetter and reference site for other institutions who are looking to implement clinical decision support. So really kind of serving, let's say, as a mentor. And I know, Dr. Wakefield, you talked about, obviously the scholarly track is an important venue, right? Being able to educate and create those publications as time, you know, permits and we evolve through these projects and so forth. And So I guess, you know, share for both of you, sharing your ideas on how do you really see MUHC serving in that mentorship role for other institutions?
I mean, we have that academic mission as well as the clinical one, and teaching and research are part of it. We have partnered with different industry partners to come with innovations that we can engage our clinicians and our researchers and helping to vet and build and innovate on top of. And that creates a situation of learning and experience that we can share with other organizations and we can work through, such as HIMSS and CHIME and other industry venues that we work through. So, you know, I like to think that as we go through the journey and we try to continuously improve, some of the benefits that we would have is being able to share those experiences, make it easier potentially for those that are coming behind us and trying to implement some of the technologies, learning and collaborating with those that are either in process or are further ahead than us to help build on it. So it really matters, you know, who we're talking to within the journey, but it's part of our culture and our organization here at MU Health to want to try to work and see it as part of our mission to share that information broadly.
Dr. Wakefield?
So the complexity or the variability of decision-making, especially in the realm of prostate cancer, you know, sometimes it's easy. Sometimes you're doing well and your PSA is zero and there's no evidence of disease recurrence. And I'll see you back in a year, right? That's reassuring and pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. But much of our time, it can be more complex. And even those scenarios, we're asking ourselves, for example, in our multidisciplinary urologic oncology tumor board, harder questions every time about, does someone need genetic testing, for example, or what is the appropriate interval of follow-up? You know, should we be utilizing this specific radiographic intervention at this time? Or do we need to wait for a higher PSA? And if we make changes in our decision-making with something like this, it's important for us to know academically whether the outcomes for our patients improve. In other words, we should be testing the hypothesis that will improve the quality of care by more appropriate utilization of resources, both diagnostic and therapeutic. Otherwise, we've really just made a cool add-on toy to our EMR if we're not really helping the patients. And then I'm toying with the idea of how do we measure the impact on the provider's well-being. So there's been a lot of interest in the last few years about physician burnout and wellness, and our institution is really concerned about the provider well-being, and that's been exaggerated, as you mentioned earlier, the pandemic. And it's one of the great joys of Brian's career, because it's always the EMR's fault, right? Physician burnout and wellness is all related to the EMR. Well, now we have an opportunity to make the EMR a better tool for us, and we should be able to measure its impact on the well-being of the providers using, in addition to asking the scholarly question of, have we actually made a difference for our patients' well-being? Did we decrease our variation? Did we improve our cost effectiveness? So that's why these type of projects appeal to me.
Mm-hmm. That's great. The infamous quadruple aim, right? That's a position. Absolutely. So in closing, this is, I think, an interesting perspective that I'd love to hear from both of you is, you know, so obviously Siemens Healthineers is, you know, the partner for you in this clinical decision support journey. So if you had a request or questions to our leadership specifically as you move forward in, you know, in this transformation, what would those be? And I totally know that it's kind of off the cuff question, but it's an important question for us.
I'll start. And I would say that just recognition of the breadth that it takes. And we like to work with several partners in the industry. And I think that it does take a broad group. There's such variety in the different technologies that are out there. And there's a lot to choose from. And I think for our partners to recognize that it's not likely right now that any one of them is going to own kind of the entire end-to-end set of solutions that we need in order to accomplish our goals. So being willing to collaborate across platforms and with other vendors and in the spaces that we need that collaboration to occur. And then I think to take into account the overall workflows that we're asking our providers and our patients to go through and map those out and look at the value portions of it and how can we add value to those workflows. I think it's a lot to ask. I know that there's definitely a thought of, you know, having more integration or having different workflows that maybe a vendor would own could be better from a perspective of the vendor, but we're trying to think through, you know, our providers and our patients' workflows as kind of the paramount piece of it.
And Dr. Wakefield?
I think it's a good point. I mean, I think that in the arenas of medicine where technology is rapidly progressing, therapeutically and diagnostically, you know, the clinician-patient relationship is not going to be negated by support, but how do we get information that is most valuable for the clinical decision on that particular day and time to be right in front of including all of the possible important variables displayed heads up, if you will, to the provider in the clinical environment. That type of forward-looking interface of data to the clinician is what I would like to see.
Great. Well, thank you both. Wonderful conversation and truly always a pleasure. And I certainly look forward to continuing our discussions and going through all the learnings that we anticipate as we move forward with your transformation. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.